Welcome to As It Is, a 30-minute program designed for English learners. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn, Pete Musto, Christopher Jones-Cruz, Anne Ball, and Anna Mateo. First, here is Brian Lynn.
People in Ivory Coast's largest city have tired of youth gang members who have terrorized parts of Abidjan. Abidjan residents say the young men and boys, some as young as 10 years old, have been linked to attacks, robberies, and even murders. The residents call these youth gangs microbes, the French word for germs. They are very dangerous elements, said one woman about the groups, adding that they usually control local streets at night. A few days ago, she said, they attacked an internet cafe. The gangs started in a crowded, poor neighborhood of Abidjan called Abobo. It is not known exactly how many microbes there are, but the best estimate is several hundred. One man said that even when people catch gang members doing criminal acts and turn them over to police, they are seen back on the streets days later. Police do organize raids and arrest the microbe, but many get released quickly because they are so young. There is no follow-up, no justice, the man said. So next time, we won't take him to authorities. He will be lynched, and that's all, the man added. Last month, angry residents killed a 19-year-old gang chief in the street. That attack fueled revenge attacks on citizens. Some residents have set up their own self-defense groups to deal with the problem. A man named Issa leads one of those groups. He said gang members are attacking mothers and parents in the neighborhood in very violent ways. He added that police had only a single car patrolling the neighborhood, and this is not enough to protect residents. He compared the situation to being trapped with lions and not being able to defend yourself. Some resident groups arm themselves with sticks and long knives while guarding the streets at night. But Esau said carrying defensive weapons did not stop the violence, so they have now turned to a different method. We told ourselves we should try to establish trust between us and these kids, he said. Residents are now trying to listen to gang members and try to understand what causes them to turn to crime. Most of the gang members still have parents, but they mainly live away from them on the streets. One young man said he has nothing to eat at home because no one in his family has a job. I had to take care of myself, he said. The government is trying to reach out to gang members. The government also has a program to protect vulnerable children. Leontine Zagbar heads the program through Ivory Coast's Ministry of Women, Family, and Child Protection. When you have no self-esteem, you have nothing to lose and will do anything, she said. The government is trying to help some gang members get their self-esteem back. A test project last year sent about 70 teenagers to a rehabilitation center to learn work-related skills like mechanics, woodworking, and sewing. But many former Mikrab still have trouble when they try to get a job. I'm Brian Lynn.
A Russian group working to restrict information on the internet is seeking advice from Chinese experts. Russia's Safe Internet League met in Moscow last month with China's powerful censors, including Fang Bangjing. He is known as one of the creators of the Great Firewall of China. The Safe Internet League is registered as a non-governmental organization, but it reportedly has links to important Russian officials. Observers say the recent meeting shows that government officials in the two countries want to increase their control of the internet. Fang spoke to the gathering about cyber sovereignty. He said national borders should be guarded in the online world as they are in the real world. And he said foreign interference with a country's government should not be accepted. Luo Wei is China's chief of cybersecurity and internet policy. He said online freedom is not a right, but a responsibility. He said it should be limited because it could lead to terrorism, according to a message on the social media website Twitter from a Financial Times newspaper reporter. Luo agreed with Russian officials who say Western media are leading an information war against their two countries. Both Chinese and Russian officials at the meeting said that American business interests have too much control of the internet. Konstantin Malofiev is the chairman of the Safe Internet League. Observers say he is linked to both the Russian government and the Russian-supported rebels in eastern Ukraine. He said Russia should learn from China's internet censorship practices and protect its sovereignty online. Russian internet experts say the meeting shows that the Russian government plans to take increasing control of online information ahead of parliamentary elections. The vote will take place September 18th. Russia will hold its presidential election in 2018. Andrei Soldatov is a Russian investigative reporter. He co-wrote the book The Red Web, The Struggle Between Russia's Digital Dictators and the New Online Revolutionaries. He told VOA he believes the government wants to be sure that it can control the internet before the elections. Russian officials began to watch social media more closely after it was used to organize large anti-government protests in 2011 and 2012. Ilya Klishin is the chief of digital media at the independent Russian television station TV Rain. He told VOA, "They thought if you control the television stations, I mean like major TV stations, then you're good, then you control the public opinion." At that point, they found out that even internet news websites and people on Facebook and Twitter can actually organize 100,000-person demonstrations in downtown Moscow. Anton Nosik is a longtime blogger in Moscow. Russian officials charged him with extremism one day before the meeting of the Russian and Chinese internet experts. The charges are connected to online statements he made about Syria. He compared the country's government to Nazi Germany and wrote that it should be destroyed. The comments came just after Russia began its air campaign to support the Syrian government against rebels. Nosek could face a fine of thousands of dollars and a 4-year prison term. Nosek told VOA that Russian lawmakers are competing with each other to write bills that would censor and control information on the internet. He says some of them are doing it because they want attention and to be included in the next parliament. He says lawmakers have written, in his words, so many laws to limit internet freedom in very many different ways. Reporter Andrei Soldatov says the government targets well-known bloggers and activists for a reason. Because the Russian system, in large part, is based on intimidation and instigating self-censorship among journalists and among users of social networks and bloggers. Experts believe the government will continue to try to intimidate independent journalists. But Klishin from TV Rain does not believe Russia will block large websites or social networks, as China does. It's not like in China or even in Turkey where they had YouTube or Twitter blocked. So far, they have never blocked a major social network or web platform like Gmail or YouTube or Twitter, he says. If they banned Facebook in Russia, then everyone would notice. Russia is following China's practice of forcing all foreign internet service providers to place their servers with Russian data inside Russia. Soldatov says Russian security services would have all the providers' technologies of encryption immediately available. Western companies have resisted placing their servers in Russia, but some Chinese companies have started to do so. I'm Pete Musto.
Doctors in Pakistan are studying two brothers who seem in fine health during the day but are unable to move when the sun goes down. The school-age boys, 9-year-old Shoaib Ahmed and 13-year-old Abdul Rashid, live near the city of Quetta. They have been called solar kids because of their condition. Their father, Mohammed Hashim, says the boys lead a perfectly normal life during the day. But once the sun goes down, they go into a vegetative state. They are unable to walk, talk, or even open their eyes. They can't eat or drink, nor get up or lay down, the father said. But we are hopeful they will be okay by the grace of God, he added. A team of 38 doctors has performed hundreds of tests on the boys in an effort to identify the possible cause of their condition. Pakistan's government is providing free medical care to their family. Doctors have sent blood samples to researchers in other countries. They have also conducted tests on other family members. And researchers have gone to the boys' village to collect soil and air samples. Dr. Javed Akram is with Pakistan's Institute of Medical Sciences in Islamabad. He said the nightly paralyzation of the boys remains a big mystery. What we have understood from research is that it happens when neurotransmitters in the brain suffer imbalance, he said. Dr. Akram's team is currently working with doctors in 5 other countries to learn more about the condition. They guide us a lot, and we are moving forward together on this, he said. The boy's father has a simple theory about what causes the condition. I think my sons get energy from the sun, he said. But doctors have already ruled out the possibility that sunlight is responsible. They note that the boys can move normally during the day, even when kept in a dark room or during a storm. I'm Brian Lynn.
A science museum in Denver, Colorado, is working to increase the number of American girls who grow up to be scientists. The Denver Museum of Nature and Science recently held a Girls and Science Day. The event gave over 10,000 girls the chance to meet women in science and to listen to them talk about seeking a science career. In the United States, most scientists and engineers are men. Compared to boys, the number of girls who grow up to be scientists is low. American educators have long noted the importance of the 4 fields known as STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Experts believe that increasing the number of women in the STEM fields needs to start early, when girls are in middle school, or when they are even younger. For Girls and Science Day, the Denver Museum of Science and Nature invited more than 300 women to the museum. All of them work in science-related fields, but have different areas of expertise. The women volunteered their time to talk with the girls and demonstrate what they do. One of the volunteers was Daniela Castaneda, an environmental engineer. She used a model to show how the city of Denver makes sure its water is safe to drink.
And so you'll see how the water that comes out the bottom is pretty clean. And this is what we'll do in water treatment plants, is we'll use filters.
The museum gave the girls a chance to capture toy birds. Volunteer Emily Snowd Brenneman is a field biologist. She told girls and their families what she does with real birds to study their behavior.
We actually put this little device called a radio track on them, and then we actually glue it to the back, then we can track their movement.
Another volunteer was Tanesha Ross, an aerospace engineer. She showed the girls a computer circuit board from the International Space Station. The equipment, she noted, was in need of repair.
I'm going to put this board under the microscope, and then you let me know if it helps you see the part better, okay? All right, here we go.
Boys were also welcome at the Girls and Science Day. The museum wants girls and boys to know about the opportunities they have to become scientists. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Computers and other machines have and will continue to change the way people do business and how we live. many researchers use the term artificial intelligence to describe the thinking and intelligent behavior demonstrated by machines. While AI can be helpful to human beings, scientists warn it can also be a threat. We live with artificial intelligence all around us. A few examples are iPhone's personal assistant, Siri, searches on the internet, and autopilot programs on airplanes. AI is not new, but it is quickly getting more and more complex and, well, more intelligent. Stuart Russell teaches computer science at the University of California, Berkeley. He says humans should be sure to make AI products that we like.
If we are going to make systems that are more intelligent than us, it's absolutely essential for us to understand how to absolutely guarantee that they only do things that we are happy with.
In the future, Russell says, many of today's jobs that require a lot of physical labor will be replaced by machines with artificial intelligence. These include agricultural jobs and ones with repetitive duties, like telephone call centers. AI machines could also replace jobs like ones in the financial industry, jobs that require studying a lot of data. This could lead to more questions.
But if we've replaced all the jobs that require human physical labor, and then we replace all the jobs that require human mental labor, then you have to ask, well, what's left?
Russell sees artificial intelligence changing the economy and current way of life.
Most people will be employed, possibly even self-employed, in providing individualized personal services to other human beings, that we won't have mass employment in manufacturing or in financial services.
He says that means the large factory or large office building with thousands of people doing the same thing will go away. Gurudith Bonnivar is IBM's Chief Science Officer of Cognitive Computing. He sees a future where new jobs such as data engineering will be created.
The future will require everybody to work with these learning reasoning machines. So I think the skill set for many of these jobs will end up being different in the future.
The healthcare industry is one area artificial intelligence is already changing. AI can process huge amounts of data so doctors can use the most up-to-date information to diagnose and treat patients. IBM's Watson technology is already in use at hospitals in North and South America, Europe, and Asia. Bonnivar says Watson helps doctors keep up with information.
The difference between having, you know, going to a doctor who has Watson versus not having Watson is very big, because when doctors, when you go to a doctor today, you might find somebody who is 10 years out of date.
There is also a dangerous side to artificial intelligence. One example is combining drone aircraft technology and AI to create autonomous weapons. Stuart Russell is working to create international treaties to ban such weapons. He says the risk is that people will use this technology to develop a kind of poor man's nuclear weapon.
But it is a race against time, because the weapons are starting to emerge. The research is moving into development. Development is moving into production.
IBM's Bonnivar points out the value of artificial intelligence, including search engines and the autopilot function on planes. The debate about whether artificial intelligence is good or bad for humans continues. Researchers agree there is no question that the technology is here and will continue to change life on our planet. I'm Ann Ball.
A publisher from Dhaka, Bangladesh, received an award for courage from a group of American publishers. The Shutashar Publishing House received the 2016 Jerry Labor International Freedom to Publish Award from the Association of American Publishers International Freedom to Publish Committee. The annual award is given to publishers outside the U.S. who have demonstrated courage in the face of restrictions on freedom of expression. Shutashar is the publisher of mostly secular and scientific books. It received the award for producing books from writers facing threats and attacks by Islamic militants. Mahbub Laylan is the co-founder of Shutashar Publishing House. He received the award at the Penn Literary Gala in New York City. He said the award honors all the writers and publishers who have died for their work in Bangladesh. Shutashar has published books by Obhijit Roy and Onanto Biju Das. These two Bangladeshi American writers were killed in Bangladesh by the militants last year. Jeff Chandler is the chairman of the IFTPC. He praised the publisher's courage to publish in the face of horrific threats of violence against yourself and your family, especially when your government is not only unwilling to help, but actually siding with the killers. Laylan told VOA the Freedom to Publish Award encourages us to keep moving ahead with our mission. The government of Bangladesh did not comment on the publishing house winning the award. Efforts by VOA to reach Bangladeshi government officials for comment have been unsuccessful. Shutashar was started in Bangladesh in 2004. The publishing house became a place for progressive Bengali writers. It has been the starting point of careers for many writers. Shutashar has published the first work of at least 1,000 writers. Today, Shutashar has more than 3,000 writers. The Islamic militants began targeting the writers and activists in 2013. Shutashar Publishing House also began receiving threats. In 2015, a group of men with knives and guns attacked the office in Dhaka. One of the founders, Ahmadur Rasid Choudhury Tootle, was in the office along with two writers. They managed to escape with only injuries. On the same day, the attackers killed another publisher of secular books in Dhaka. Co-founders Laylan Tootle and Zafir Setu have fled Bangladesh in fear for their lives. They have left Shutashar closed in recent months. The closing is only temporary. Tootle said, Shutashar has not been closed permanently. Since we have still been receiving threats, for reasons related to the security of our employees, we have kept our regular work at the publishing house on hold. The publishers at Shutashar say they are in the process of publishing on the internet. Several e-book projects are currently being written. I'm Anna Mateo.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.